Introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, weekly blog talk radio show with your show host Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about issues related to John Lennon's song Imagine, which has often been called the atheist anthem, anthem for atheists, because we want to discuss a new book, a republication of a 1971 book, The Gods of Atheism, by the Catholic priest and commentator Vincent P. Michelli, and he an excellent, insightful commentator, wrote numerous books before his death in 1991. And we want to discuss this re-release of this book, covering leading atheists like Friedrich Nietzsche and Karl Marx, with the spokesperson of its publisher, Sophia Institute Press spokesperson, Kristen Van Uden. Well, Kristen, are you there? Thank you for joining the show.
I made it. Nice to hear from you, Andrew.
Okay. Well, we were wondering here. You were wondering if you had a schedule conflict, might have to come in a little bit late. Well, just starting out here, this is a really a very interesting book, a really encyclopedic book, over 400 pages, covering all sorts of leading atheist thinkers. You know, starts out with a foreword from Cardinal John Wright, who is a previous prefect for the Sacred Congregation of the Clergy. And he writes in this foreword that man remains unalterably God-centered. He cannot exist without a God. And if he rejects the true God, he will invariably, instinctively, even perversely create his own false God. Well, why is man God-centered?
That's the central question of the book, right? And really is reflected even the title itself, The Gods of Atheism, because that seems like an oxymoron, right? Atheism is the absence of God. But as Father Michelli points out, that is not true. Because man is made in the image and likeness of God, we have this teleological sense of moving towards God. Our identity and our final end are in God, and we just can't change that, no matter how much we deny it or try to distract it. It is built, hardwired into the human person, even if they spend their entire life trying to avoid that reality. And so Father Michelli points out that atheism is not the absence of God, but rather the worship of idols, because that sense of needing to worship something is always implicit in the human being. And so if God is not the object of that worship, something else will be. If God is removed from his place of primacy in the heart and in the soul, really, and all of these false idols will arise. And as he explains, most often that false idol is the self. And this is why all of these creeds of atheism are really at their core prideful and centered on glorifying the self. And then when you take that to its Kantian moral imperative, glorifying man as a human person, absent of God. And really, this is the creed of Lucifer, of claiming that his will was better than God's will. And of all the problems that have arisen in the world are from this central error of not submitting to the will of God and instead placing man, or it could be money, it could be science, as we see often today, but anything that's not God in God's place. And that is what atheism, despite its name, claims to do. And Father Michele actually says that it should more rightly be termed as anti-theism, because it's defined by what it hates and by what it rejects, rather than by believing in something else, positive or productive.
Well, okay, so you're talking about the telos, the teleological nature of man. You're saying that, you know, I guess human beings, we conceive of the infinite and of the internal, of, you know, my life is not going to just end with my death or something, but there has to be something beyond that. I can think of something beyond, or I can think of, say, transcended values like good and evil and so forth. So there must be clearly something beyond my physical life and this physical world. So as many people have stated before, that humanity then is indeed, as you're indicating, really sort of hardwired for God, for the infinite, for the eternal. But is not then atheism growing today? I mean, we've heard from various academics or people in the media have sometimes suggested that, you know, religion is something of the past, you know, that with modernity, mm-hmm. you know, religion just dies out.
Yes, atheism is definitely on the rise today, and Father Michele explains how this is not an organic development. So really, in the world today, atheism is almost the default state, at least in the West, right? It's kind of, if you are religious at all, you're an aberration, never mind trying to follow the way, the truth, and the life. But this is not something that happened organically. This is something, as he explains in the book, that actually has its origins in a very specific set of thinkers from the Enlightenment period onwards that he profiles in the book. He chooses 17 of these sort of godfathers of atheism who really, although they did not all know each other, they all worked in concert to bring about this state of affairs as we have it today. This, the ideas of your average atheist walking on the street today, sad to say, as they will deny this, but they did not come from them. They're actually following the creeds of these men, like Nietzsche and Heidegger and others mentioned in the book, who made it their goal in life to unsub about how atheism occurs on a spectrum, and atheists, as he says, are made, not born. And so since we all are born with this innate religious sense, atheism is a constructed identity that requires some thought and acts of the will on the part of the atheist. And he describes what he calls as practical atheism as being the forerunner to doctrinal atheism, where he says that even a man in the state of mortal sin is practically acting almost as an atheist, because he is practically rejecting God's will and God's law, and he's placing himself at the center. And so anytime a prideful act takes over the human person, then they are acting in a way that predisposes them to reject God altogether. And so atheism is basically a massive cope for pride, for not wanting to put aside pride, for wanting to instead enshrine the self rather than submit to God and recognize sin. So he talks about how these creeds are drawn up to cloak this central desire and the central refusal to sort of affirm through relativism what the satanic creed tells us, do as thou wilt, right? And it's important to remember that the world was not always this way. So that's another wake-up call that he brings in the book, is that the default state of man before the current, you know, modern era from 19th century onward was Catholicism in Christendom, and before that paganism in other countries, and you know, in Abrahamic times Judaism. So religious sense was always acted upon, and in paganism in the wrong way and erroneously, but never before until the Enlightenment have we had this out and out denial of metaphysics altogether and the supernatural realm altogether. And he really pinpoints the Enlightenment as the marked time at which this shift happened. So before the Enlightenment, everything, the philosophy developed along Christian lines, using a priori thinking, before the fact, things that were self-evident. And then after the Enlightenment, that was all turned on its head. So empiricism was enshrined. Anything that you could not have tangible evidence for was considered to be a myth. and this after-the-fact thinking that really, as he terms it, is impossible to prove God on these scientific empiricist terms. So they're demanding something that is not even possible, has completely shifted the narrative so that whereas before the idea that there is a God at least was something that was a default belief of most humans, that has been flipped on its head. And so now the atheists have cleverly placed the burden of proof on their terms onto Christians. So that's kind of a long history of how he marks this intellectual progress, but that explains the state of the world that we're in today.
Well, you mentioned a growing atheism today in the modern West. People have often talked about that, you know, particularly in Europe, and now increasingly so in the United States. But as you mentioned, you know, throughout mm-hmm. history, you know, that's really something new, that people are just denying any sort of supernatural mm-hmm. realm altogether. Well, what about other parts of the world today? I mean, like, you know, there's often talk of, like, growing Christianity even under repression in communist China, or, you know, mm-hmm. of course, you know, that we've from past decades, we've dealt with, you know, religious zeal and fanaticism in Islamic countries and various threats from there. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you have sectarian violence between Hindus and Muslims in India. Is the rest of the world also becoming atheistic? Or what's the difference between the modern West and the rest of the world such that we have this growth of atheism here?
Yeah, I think the rest of the world has not been infected with the plague of the modern West has. And this is something I've noticed in my own study of persecuted Catholics under communism and interviewing people, is that when your faith must be practiced under duress, people are naturally more zealous, right? There's more understanding of the importance of faith. Whereas in the decadent West, when life is easy, it's easier to forget God. And this is why atheists always promise utopia, because they know if they give the people bread and circuses, they won't need to turn to God. But it's ironically through suffering that people often even ask the question of, why is this happening to me? And then that brings them to religion, that brings them to God. And so comfort is always something that atheists and in Father Michelli's other book on the Antichrist himself really promises and promotes, is because if you can keep these people in this, you know, sort of zombified state of not having to ask the big questions about life, not having to reckon with the questions of death and the afterlife in the meaninglessness of this world, if you can keep them distracted and drugged and entertained, watching TV, stuck to their phones, running the rat race, then it's so much easier to write God out of the picture. And so I think that's the problem in the West. Even Islam is seen as very attractive by people looking for deeper meaning in life, because it's a very virile, strong, you know, religion with a purpose. And to the average disaffected Western man that is stuck in a cubicle all day, anything but that, when he does search for that deeper meaning, will be appealing. And so it's about, in the West, it's about first waking up from the realization that despite hedonism and pleasure and the comfort afforded by Western secularism, you're not happy there. And then realizing that you are looking for deeper, more meaningful creeds that can inspire you to even die for them, that's when atheists are unhappy, because that's when the questions start being asked. But that's also when the greatest moments of faith can happen, and is when you reject both this Western ideal and the false promises of pagan religions that center on the self, and really understand that who you are as a human being is who Jesus is calling you to be, and can understand your true identity there.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of similar things. I remember at a presentation at the Family Research Council about some 8 years ago or so, Michael Brown, the evangelical writer, he actually came from a Jewish background and became Christian, was talking about saying that only Christianity, or only the, you know, the biblical West, if you Judeo-Christian West, if you think of, you know, countries like Christian countries like the United States or Europe, or for that matter, Israel. Only these countries have really had to face modernity. Only their faith. I mean, these countries, the West, have created, as you describe, you know, this modern sort of peaceful, prosperous world. We don't have, you know, dictatorships or famine or, such crises as really we have. You know, as Francis Fukuyama wrote at the end of the Cold War, we in the West have reached this kind of end of history moment where we've achieved a stable governance, and we've lost any sort of battles over sort of the very nature of our society over questions like slavery or genocide or something like that. And so we have this kind of comfortable existence, whereas, you know, other places in the world, in India or Islamic world or so forth, are much, have not reached that sort of development. I mean, they're much more backward, much poorer, you know, not as well educated. I mean, a big thing, you know, in the West, you have mass education. So, you know, people can be skeptical. They can question. They can really make choices. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't do that in Afghanistan, say, with a largely illiterate population just indoctrinated into Islam. So, yeah, atheism is something that, you know, it has to grow up in this sort of peaceful, prosperous environment where people are, you know, do indeed have the liberty to choose, to contemplate, and to decide whether or not to be faithful. But, you know, you talk about it,
yeah,
as Shelley writes,
no atheists in foxholes.
Oh yes, indeed, of course, yes. The that, of course, that phrase. You know, when you're really confronted with some danger, you really start to think of things. I mean, of course, like there are times of, you know, like a natural disaster or something in the United States or whatever. You know, if people lose their homes or something, then, you know, people really start to think about wanting some help from someone, some love. You notice, as Michelli writes, he writes, atheists like saints are made, not born. It is not easy to become a saint, and as well, it's not easy to become an atheist. And that, so you're indicating that atheists are actually battling their nature, human nature. How have the lives of various atheists shown this?
Yeah, well, it was really surprising and saddening for me to read about some of these figures, because I thought I knew Nietzsche, for example, but I never actually knew that he was somewhat of a strong Christian growing up. I had known his father was a Lutheran minister. He had this background, at least inherited or culturally, but Father Michelli includes some of Nietzsche's earlier writings when he was still a Christian. That is really, like, I could not believe it was coming from the pen of the greatest known atheist the world has experienced. I'll just read a short little passage here from Nietzsche before his apostasy, where he says, "I have already experienced many things, joy as well as sadness, lightness of heart as well as depression, but in all these things God has certainly led me as a father might lead his helpless little child. He has already imposed much suffering on me, but in all this I recognize with reverence his majestic power, which has everything turn out for the best. I have firmly resolved to devote myself to his service forever." And clearly that did not happen. So the lives of these profiles, and this is why I think biography is so useful as a genre, because you can see all of these big ideas and things that are recorded in statistics play out in the lives of individual people, because that's how we experience the world, is as individual people. And so before Nietzsche's crusade against God, he was living as the practical atheist, as Father Michelli identified earlier. And today I wrote an article for Catholic Exchange called How to Make an Atheist, so that describes the sort of fall from grace into atheism. And one of the big steps along that process is to sow doubt. So this is where especially a lot of these figures who were enamored with empiricism and science started to doubt the existence of God. Another big one is the worship of the self. So we've talked about this already, but the just refusal to combat one's own selfishness and to recognize that as a fallen state of human nature, and kind of this entitlement complex. Another thing is attacking the dignity of God. And so As Father Hubert Van Zeller, who's another somewhat of a contemporary, lived a little bit before Michelli, wrote, "Where the dignity of Christ is lost sight of, the divinity follows suit." So if you have an undignified liturgy, for example, lex orandi, lex credendi, the law of worship is the law of belief. So in many of these men's lives who were profiled, they sort of first started by mocking God and by making fun of religion and religious people before they had developed a fully fledged doctrine or crusade against God. And then the final thing that is very sad in many of their lives is an inability to understand suffering. And this is the big problem with the existentialists, especially, who are covered towards the middle of the book, Sartre's Hollow Universe, as just the problem of suffering. And, of course, the Catholic Church provides the answer to that, which is that we are a fallen species and that Christ himself had to suffer more than anyone else has ever suffered in order to save us from that, to save us from sin, and that in this fallen world, happiness as such is not possible. It's only possible through transcendence, through Christ. And so that is the central thing that atheists cannot accept. And interestingly, that's also the central thing demons can't accept, is the incarnation, how Christ became a small little human to save us from sin. And so in Nietzsche's own life and in others in the book, this run-in with sad experiences and loss and suffering and pain and physical sickness, especially too, makes them doubt the existence of a loving God. They doubt God's love, and then they doubt God's existence, naturally following from that.
Well, thinking of Nietzsche, you know, the book notes that he came from this Protestant, this Lutheran background. Michelli makes some comments here in the book. He talks about sort of the breakdown of a Christendom, of a Christian world, and he talks about, for example, the Reformation. It broke down a unitary Christian society. You know, there are other developments after that, like, you know, this elevation of reason and the Enlightenment and much of Enlightenment thinking to the exclusion of faith. I mean, you see that in the French Revolution.
Yep.
Are there any differences in the influence of what is the role then? I guess looking at it from Michelli's Catholic perspective, has sort of Protestantism and the breakdown of this unitary Christendom, how has that related to atheism or advanced it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is really interesting that many of these figures came from a very intense Protestant background. So he even discusses Bonhoeffer in the book, and Nietzsche is the big major example. And then I believe Feuerbach was also a Protestant first, even the first figure that he covers. And so really the question is posed is the fact that these men had an erroneous view of who God was to begin with, part of what pushed them towards atheism. The idea especially of a vengeful Old Testament God that sort of like the Puritan ideal that de-emphasizes Christ's love and mercy is something that, you know, may naturally result in atheism for people, because at least in the Old Testament, you know, God was acting in this way, but the Savior was still coming. But now that the Savior has come and has abrogated the Old Covenant, rather fulfilled it in the New, an idea of God being perceived in that way without Christ is an incomplete idea. It's an incomplete understanding of the Trinity. And so Michelli definitely discusses how these thinkers had a false view of God to begin with, so that what they were rejecting was not in fact God and his true nature, but rather a parody of God or a misconception of God.
Other readings I've had on Karl Marx is also profiled in the book. You know, Karl Marx, of course, came from an assimilated Jewish background. His grandparents had been rabbis, but then as Michelli notes, it says his father became Lutheran. And I recall reading somewhere else in another book that about Karl Marx that, you know, he actually really was himself in this sort of new Lutheran background. He was actually really, really hated Jews himself, or was really kind of, you know, anti-Semitic, really had a lot of rejection of or anger towards his Jewish ancestors, his Jewish people. So kind of strange there.
Yeah.
But You talk about issues of evidence, and this comes up then with another thinker profiled in the book, the French thinker in the early 19th century, Auguste Comte, who his theory of positivism. I mean, you say that, you know, you can't really ultimately prove God conclusively, his existence through science. Why should science, the empirical evidence, the physical world, is that the only way to prove truth? Is that the only source of truth?
No, and in fact, it wasn't seen that way until the Enlightenment. So before that, the means of proving truth were metaphysical proofs. So if you've ever done this in philosophy class, they're a lot of fun, actually, where, like, the ontological proof of St. Anselm for the existence of God, for example, you start with a premise, and then it's like a mathematical proof, but it's just dealing with the things of metaphysics. And I don't remember that one by heart, but it's when you suspend all belief in metaphysics, then it's impossible to argue with atheists, because they believe that nothing exists except for the material world. So they reject even the premise and even the evidence. And so it was that major shift, and really an intellectual dishonesty, that means that we're not even speaking the same language when we're trying to have these discussions. Because, of course, there is physical evidence for God, and we see even with developments in science, like the Big Bang Theory, for example, and whatever it is now, but they all point towards this prime mover, right, and this initial creator. And so if you want to argue on the level of empiricism, fine, but that's not all we are as humans. And anyone living, if they were honest with themselves, would recognize that they're more than their bodies, they're more than the synapses in their brain, and that their feelings and intellect point to an eternal soul. And yet they do deny even that. So Father Michele makes the point again and again that a denial of God is really a denial of the self, and he calls it a decapitated love, a decapitated self-love, the love of man without the love of God, because man is made in the image of likeness of God. That's just unavoidable. And when you view man in this really decapitated way, merely a materialist being, then you're not really loving man, because you're not really defining man properly. So, yeah, to get back to your initial question, though, just these arguments are impossible to have, because you don't even start with the same premise anymore. So really the rules of academia up until the Enlightenment were completely just imploded. And now that's why so many of these arguments just devolve into just nonsense, really.
Talking about issues of reason and evidence and so forth, you mentioned Ludwig Feuerbach, one of the first people covered in the book. Just to discuss his theories about how, he turned away from God and emphasized just sort of a human reason as a basis for morality and human happiness.
Yes, so Feuerbach's trajectory is somewhat interesting, because he displays sort of the trajectory of a practical atheist. So one of the first things that he did was to desacralize sacraments and to strip them of really any supernatural meaning that they had, and that was sort of a step on his way to writing a theory of atheism. And he pushed something known as utopian Christianity. He wrote a book called The Essence of Christianity, which really misrepresents Christianity. And he uses it to promote a more man-centric religion, which is what we see. All of them materially belong to the religion of man. Auguste Comte even, interestingly, created his own religion. He was a very scientific-minded person, a child of the French Revolution later on, but he founded what's called the religion of humanity with its own rituals and feast days and practices, which is the same as positivism, as we were talking about. So all of them kind of want to keep some sort of semblance of religion, and that's what we can see with Feuerbach, is he's not completely throwing out the idea of God. He's just really misrepresenting him. His famous line, Feuerbach, is, "I am going to make theologians anthropologians." And so his central error, again, is decentering God, placing man as the study at the center, and not understanding man's vertical relation to God, but rather, and this is called immanence rather than transcendence, right? Believing God arises from man rather than is from God, and that there is a transcendent reality.
Well, that's interesting. You know, looking at Feuerbach, one of the questions I have is, does atheism, I guess we maybe mentioned this in other ways, does atheism arise equally from other faiths or just Christianity? I mean, here Feuerbach, you know, he wants to get rid of any supernatural and just reduce everything to a matter of reason, of man's reason, and kind of a new belief system, a new religion. You know, could say a Muslim or a Hindu think up that idea, or is that really something that comes from the Bible with its emphasis on a rational humanity made in the image of God, the ultimate reason?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, is that as far as I know, there are no atheists who came from other religions. It's just from a rejection of the Christian God. And when you hear just your standard atheists today, what they are railing against is the Christian God. They're not railing against, you know, the idea of the demiurge or an idea of millions of gods. In Hinduism, for example, they're railing against God. They define him as the Christian God, and they just choose to hate him. So that is a very interesting point. As far as I know, I have not heard of atheists coming from other religions. I would imagine Hindu atheists would more so just drift towards Buddhism and the system of philosophy rather than theology. And Michele points out that for Feuerbach, that was the first step down, is reducing theology to philosophy and then eventually just to anthropology and then creating a religion from there. So you see people like, not covered in the book, but like Rudolf Steiner, for example, the father of anthroposophism, took theosophy, which is already a pagan occult, bad news, but decentered God even there and made it about man. just constantly what we see. But do you know, Andrew, of any maybe Muslim atheists? You would know better than I.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess I can't really think of any sort of leading thinkers. I mean, for example, dealing with issues of Islam, I mean, there are indeed, you know, Muslim atheist groups, you know, ex-Muslim atheists, you know, there's like ex-Muslims of North America and so forth, and you have individuals like Yasmin Muhammad, who wrote the book Unveiled and focuses particularly on issues of, you know, women under Islam and how, you know, they suffer under doctrines like hijab and veiling and things like that. But you know, in terms of all of these leading thinkers that they would always refer to, they are indeed, you know, from the Western tradition, or, you know, modern atheist thinkers like, you know, Christopher Hitchens or, you know, late Christopher Hitchens or, you know, say Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, you know. So, again, it does strike me that, you know, atheism really is largely a Western phenomenon. I mean, a Western belief system. It hasn't really arisen in other faith systems. And I guess it comes down, again, to this issue that, you know, the Bible and the West, the Bible-based Western civilization, does indeed believe in this, in you know, man having reason in the image of God, and so perhaps you could say that atheism is kind of like a reflection of biblical faith, kind of like representing a kind of ideological civil war that people are saying, okay, well, if, you know, if you're saying we're reasoning beings made in the image of God, you know, why don't I just say, no, I'm a reasoning being, period, and let's just forget all this God stuff, you know, and you know, I just simply, I don't know, my reason came from the chemicals in my brain or something, or evolution or whatever.
Right, it's inheriting, it's like being a parasite off of the Western tradition and, you know, using the logic and reason developed in the Western tradition to reject its own heritage. It's a very odd phenomenon. And this, I think, is further evidenced by the last section of the book called God as Victims of Man, Part 4, which was just weird and fascinating to me because these figures are people who identify as Christian and Father Michele says on page 351, what makes these men so fascinating is that they are professional Christian theologians who elaborate, quote, death of God theologies that destroy the very subject of their academic, even pastoral dedication. So what sort of like intellectually suicidal contradiction is that?
Well, discuss those Christian atheists a bit more. Who are some of those figures, and where did they come from, and what sort of thoughts did they have?
So these were people I had never heard of before, and I still don't think I fully understand what they're saying because it's so nonsensical. But he profiles four of them. Vahanian, who I never heard of this man before, who calls God pallbearer. Thomas J.J. Altizer, another one who I had not heard of before. These are all mainly 20th century thinkers, so in the postmodernist era, for example. And then he moves on to William Hamilton, who was writing in the 60s. He described him as neo-Orthodox Barthian Christian, and he wrote a book called The New Essence of Christianity, which is kind of hearkening back to Feuerbach's Essence of Christianity. And then finally, the last one here is a man called Paul Van Buren, and he was more arguing from the point of linguistics, and so it's interesting. This book was written in 1971, so I would really love to see Father Michelli's analysis of the postmodernists, so people like Foucault, and then even looping in Noam Chomsky into that, who are they're all working from this a posteriori empiricist view, but like, you know, even beyond existentialism. Maybe you had heard more of these Christian atheists, but the central idea for them seems to be the death of God. And one of them, I forget which one, claimed that God committed suicide. And I'm not sure if he's referring to Christ's sacrifice, but sort of the idea of a black hole and this error that even we've heard Pope Francis say that the soul of man disappears after death if it doesn't go to heaven instead of acknowledging hell. It's sort of this anti-existence, and it's really difficult to wrap your brain around or to even discuss because, at least for me, it's just we're not dealing in reality with these so-called Christian atheists and their evidence.
Well, you made an interesting point before that, talking about a weakening of faith. You talked about diminishing the sacraments really sort of leads to atheism. I mean, we talked about these differences between Protestants and Catholics. I mean, Protestants, rejecting, say, like the idea of the Eucharist as a sacrament and so forth. I remember in another conversation I had on the show here with another author from Sophia Institute Press, Stephen Off, in his book on the Metropolitan Museum of Art, he mentioned the idea that cathedrals like Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, France, are supposed to be so magnificent precisely because in the Catholic belief, God is coming down to earth, Jesus is coming down to earth as his body and blood in the bread and wine of the Eucharist. So that's why you want to have this glorious temple, this glorious cathedral for such an event. And so watching the burning of Notre Dame in Paris was like, watching, heaven on fire, he wrote. Do the sacraments then also have a big effect on whether or not someone becomes atheist?
Definitely. And this is why this isn't so much covered in this book, but is more touched upon in Father Michelli's other book, Sophia, The Antichrist. The issue of liturgical abuse is a lot more insidious and problematic than we may initially think, is that something like the clown mass, which predominated, but was very apparent after the Second Vatican Council, is not just silly and dumb, but it's damaging because it's damaging the dignity of the liturgy. And when you think of what the liturgy is, it is literally the re-presentation of Calvary, where Jesus makes himself there, present, body, blood, soul, and divinity. The sacrifice occurs again, and then we, in a state of grace, can receive him. That is the most serious and wonderful mystery of faith, and the accoutrements that accompany it, that is the place where the Mass occurs, the vestments, the liturgy itself, the conduct of the people, stained glass and all of that, is all to remind us of the seriousness of what is happening before us and the true nature of what's happening before us. And to go back to that age-old rule of lex orandi, lex credendi, the law of worship is the law of belief. So something like communion in the hand, for example, which was introduced after the council largely, is something that just ontologically redefines our understanding of what is happening. Because if you are worthy to take God in your own hands, then really the understanding is quite different than if you must kneel to receive him only from consecrated hands. So it's things that are communicated to us, not through discussion or logic or reason, but through our body and our soul sensing these things because of our ontological disposition. And the physical location of the church even has a lot to do with that. So an argument for the glory and beauty of the church and spending money on such things is to enshrine and make sure that the proper understanding of God's identity and what's going on is preserved. Because if you're going to church in a church that looks like a spaceship or ones that I grew up with that looked like, you know, Cold War bunkers, you're just a bunch of bombs to go off at any second, then that's not inculcating in the soul, just through the senses, just through osmosis, a real sense of dignity or of supernatural transcendence. It's rather inculcating a sense of the apocalypse. And so these things are important. Aesthetics matter. They're not everything, but they serve a purpose. They subordinate to the reality of the sacrifice of the Mass, and so to just conduct and all of that.
Well, I guess looking more towards the physical and the temporal world, two key atheists covered in the book are, as we've indicated, Friedrich Nietzsche and Karl Marx. What were their beliefs, and what have their effects been on the state of man throughout history?
Yes, so the key teaching of Nietzsche was really the death of God, as he says that he walked out on the streets and declared God is dead and man has taken his place. Nietzsche developed the idea of the Übermensch, the Superman, who is a man who can live without God and who is basically acting like a prideful demon, who's basically acting as Lucifer. Nietzsche really spiraled out of control in his life. He died in a state of, complete insanity. And so it's hard to track whether some of his later work is even consistent with his earlier work, but the through line is the Superman. So here is a, quick quote from him from Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he says, "Behold, I teach you the Superman. The Superman is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say, the Superman shall be the meaning of the earth." So it's, again, enthroning man, which I feel like it becomes obvious that it's like, oh, he's making the same point over and over again with each of these figures, but that is what it is. On page 60, Father Mattelli notes that Nietzsche's will to power is an ascent to the ideal man, and this same thing, this worship of man. Nietzsche's works have also been adapted into Nazism. His sister was an avid Nazi who lived after him. She outlived him. And some have said that, there's not a causal effect from his work to that ideology. But definitely the concept of the Übermensch is just synthesized very neatly into the Nazi ideals and, transmogrified into the idea of a superior race itself, and so not only the man, but also into this racial ideology. And so fascism can be seen to be traced from Nietzsche's ideas. And then on the other hand, communism, which is made of much the same stuff of totalitarianism and the deification of man, comes from the other side, from Marx. So while his system was more based on economics and was essentially a more of a practical system for a utopia on Earth, it was still inherently atheistic at its core. Writes here on page 99, Father Mattelli even points out that at one point
Marx says, I hate all gods. And he rejects even pagan notions of gods. And so while fascism and communism, as we've discussed before, can be seen as these political enemies, their grandfathers, both of these men, were atheistic to the core and just had different ways of trying to implicate that atheism on Earth and live it out in different doctrines.
Yeah, I guess it's of course interesting that both of these thinkers, Nietzsche and Marx, are both Germans, and mm-hmm. sort of lived, were contemporaries of each other to some extent at least. So there's these two totalitarian ideologies of Marxism, communism on the one hand, and Nazism, National Socialism. They're both having influences from these two individuals in Germany. So it's a really quite a concentration of evil there. Well, talking about the Ubermensch with Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm. So much comes from Germany. Martin Luther, them.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, that extends the analysis to other things. Yeah.
What's going to happen next from Germany?
talking about this Ubermensch, I didn't know that Nietzsche's sister became a Nazi. I mean, Nietzsche himself died, I believe, in 1906? And when did his sister die? And what role did – was she just a party member, or did she have any other particular role?
I remember correctly, I'll look up the specific year. Her name's Elizabeth, and she saved his writings, and I believe she gave them somehow to leading Nazi figures, and was herself involved. It looks like she died in 1935, so these would have been in the early years. But she was really she was involved in the development of the ideology. And yes, he did place the works he gave his archives to the Nazis themselves. So she, let's see, especially the Will to Power, which makes sense. But yeah, even it would have been interesting to see if she had lived even longer throughout the war, what would have become of, people claim their distortions of his ideology, but developments of his ideology.
Well, Michelli does note in the book that Nietzsche actually condemned the anti-Semitism of, I believe, a brother. So what was Nietzsche's idea of an Ubermensch? Who should be, in his conception, I mean, if we think of in Nazism, you have the Ubermensch and these superior individuals who were, in the Nazi conception, then this master German race, the Aryans, who were, supposed to dominate, enslave, or exterminate others like Slavs or Jews. How did Nietzsche conceive of the Ubermensch, and who were they supposed to be, and who what were they supposed to do in ruling others?
As far as I understand it, by Nietzsche's criteria, the Superman did not need to have any racial components, but his main creed was that he was to smash the Judeo-Christian tablets of the moral law, and as Father Michelli puts it, to proclaim like a new Moses from a mountaintop of thunder and lightning, a new code of values, a code that arises out of the superabundance of the elite surging to vitality and will to power. So really, anyone who is not a slave to God, and Nietzsche was obviously influenced by Hegel, who had this idea of the dialectic and the master-slave dialectic, where God is the master and humans are the slaves, and this is something Feuerbach drew from as well. And so for Nietzsche, the criteria to be considered a Superman is more of a moral thing than necessarily ethnic. And somebody who rejects slave morality, as he calls it, and condemns the people who accept this so-called slave morality, he's really defined by his opposition to Christianity and his opposition to God. That's really the only thing that you need to be to be a Superman.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it sounds maybe somewhat like Marxian there. I mean, or Leninist, that you have a dictatorship of the proletariat. There'll be some sort of like kind of undefined elite or such that will somehow lead society, you know, rule for the better of society, you know, even against like the wishes of people in society. Some sort of all-knowing kind of leadership.
Right. Yeah, and that's the interesting thing is that you can't abolish this dialectic really fully, because with Marx, it's the dictatorship of the proletariat. It's not the abolishing of dictatorship, right? So somebody has to be in charge, and it's just a matter of a coup, really, a political switching of power of this set of elites who just changes identity. And then also, interestingly, from Nietzsche, there has arisen this neo-pagan sense of the Übermensch, too, and this he has its roots in his work. I don't fully understand exactly what he said about it specifically. But this whole idea that you'll see prominent on far-right circles online of the Hyperboreans, the superior group of people who descended from the North and very tied up in racial ideology. But the through line, again, as you pointed out with both of these, is that there is a sense that there is a way in which a human can be elite, member of the elite. And we can see this with the capital C traditionalists and their idea that membership in quote-unquote Aryanism is primarily spiritual and not racial, is that it's really an acceptance of their ideology, which is the core criteria for belonging to this elite. And we can see that, of course, their elite eat their own when it comes down to it, but that's how they seduce people, is that membership is somewhat loose and is based mainly on a rejection of Judeo-Christian values.
Oh, I'd never read that before. I haven't studied Nietzsche all that much, but you're suggesting he then, in his later writings, I mean, you're talking about how it's kind of contradictory that he had this sort of pagan turn, that he's starting to emphasize the kind of paganism. I mean, that brings up then again yet another sort of Nazi linkage. I mean, people have noted that the Nazis, in their ideology, precisely this idea of a Aryan master race, you know, that they became, they had all sorts of pagan rituals and so forth, emphasized like this Norse ideology, you know, pagan ideology of the Norseman.
Right, and I'm not sure exactly if that, if Nietzsche himself had those pagan beliefs or if it's just people who have declared themselves to be his disciples, but it's definitely something that is compatible and has its origins, because pagan morality, and especially Norse pagan morality, is very much about the will to power and about asserting really the Übermensch, the strong man, survival of the fittest, and hatred of the weak. And so it does go hand in hand, whether or not he only tacitly gave his approval to it or actually wrote about it.
Well, yeah, that's yeah, so thinking of, you know, the Norse, the Valhalla, and so forth. Well, I guess shifting gears here, you know, we've talked about now Nietzsche, Nazism, Germans. Another atheist profiled in the book, however, is a Frenchman who actually fought with the French resistance against the Germans in World War II, namely Albert Camus. And he was one of these leading existential thinkers, as they're called. Discuss him a bit and his ideas.
Yes, he is the father of absurdism, as listeners have probably read some of his works, like The Plague, for example, which is really riding the wave of nihilism. So Nietzsche can be considered to be the father of nihilism, where existentialism takes a leap beyond nihilism and says, it's just all absurd. This does not make sense. Kafka can be considered to be a proto-existentialist in that way. And Kierkegaard even is a forerunner against or before existentialism. But it really covers both Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre and definitely traces them to the ideals of the French Revolution, but also to these men who came immediately before them, so like Nietzsche. One of the core tenets of Sartre, for example, was in his book Being in Nothingness, Being and Nothingness, Michelli discusses, it emphasizes the metaphysical absence of God. And so, again, this is something that is centering reality on subjectivism and on toyed, especially with the idea of consciousness, and that transcendent realities, such as God, infinity,
universal principles are just, as he puts it, mere chimeras or mere mirages. And so this being in itself and the, you know, Deus ex machina kind of solipsism that really results in the Matrix, for example, and this even harkens back to Descartes, I think, therefore I am, is just the raising of the subject and of his subjective experience, and that it's meaningless. And even, it, I mean, it's quite dark. Like, they even argue that love is impossible. And so, yeah, it's, you know, a continuation along the same line.
Yeah, and the discussion that Michelli had in the book about Camus, I mean, he talks about his writings like The Stranger, one book he wrote, and this idea that, as you say, everything's absurd, there's no, you know, there's no meaning to life, it's just nihilism, and in The Stranger, he writes about a man who, in Algeria, I mean, Camus himself was born in Algeria to Spanish, French parents, and this character in the book, he kills an Arab, just in like a sort of like a fit of rage or something, or, you know, being in like a hut in the desert or something. And the book is all about how when facing his execution for this murder, this killing, the man realizes that, you know, it's just everything's meaningless and there's just no morality. Well, how should a person then, if you believe in such existentialism, how should then a person live in life? What goals should
right.
a person have?
Yeah, well, that's one of the darkest parts of The Stranger, is that when he's put to the fire and asked, why did you do this? It's like, oh, I don't know. It's like Bartleby the Scrivener. I'd prefer not to, except for with evil. And that's the most horrifying part, is that it's like we were looking in the mirror and there's nothing there. If he had killed him out of rage or out of jealousy or love or any of these other human reasons, at least that would make sense. Right? At least that would have a cause and effect. But he kills him just because he felt like it, as he says in The Stranger, because the sun was shining or something like that, right? I can't remember exactly, but it's like, oh, because the sun was shining on the desert and it was hot, so that's why I killed him. So the scary idea that man is completely unpredictable and you don't know what he's going to do from moment to moment, it's just, and because they don't believe in transcendence, it's not even that it comes from an evil force or a good force, he just is completely random, and it's untraceable and just not understandable, and that morality really is impossible after that point. So, except for do what thou will, but even that, like, what does will even mean in that context when you don't have anything that is prompting you? What is the meaning of free will when your actions are out of your control but not in anyone else's control? And that's the scary void of existentialism.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, makes me think that this is kind of like a Charles Manson belief system. I mean, it's just helter-skelter, you go crazy, and nothing matters.
Hedonism, though, emptiness. Yeah.
Mhm. Well, looking at the lives of all of these atheists, I've read before in other books, it's talked about how Karl Marx was really just a terrible person. He was a deadbeat, fathered illegitimate children, and, you know, just lived off the wealth of his family and his supporters, like Engels and so forth. And people asking questions, why would anyone want to follow a person? You've mentioned Nietzsche going insane and so forth. I mean, do the lives of these various individuals, are they lives such that they would inspire anyone to follow them? Did they live good lives? Did they have happy lives? Why would anyone want to look to these individuals and follow what they said?
I think people might look to them because they affirm their own self-hatred and their own hatred of God, and sort of this bubbling feeling that is a lie of the enemy, that it doesn't matter, there is no meaning, it's all lies. That is a temptation that all of us have. But in terms of inspirational figures, no, I have not yet encountered, especially not in this book, a truly happy atheist. Some of them may have lived pleasure-filled, hedonistic lives. But even among these thinkers, most of them don't. Most of them torture themselves and are, you know, completely in misery throughout their lives. And it's because they're defined by resentment. They're defined by, again, what they reject. They reject God. They rail against the idea of God. If God didn't exist, then why are they so obsessed with him, basically? It's like their obsession with writing all these negative things about God is kind of an argument for his existence. And so, yeah, by their fruits you shall know them. And I think that is definitely an interesting part of the book, again, is to read through the lens of these biographies, just the fact that by denying the human condition, they couldn't escape it. They rather suffered through it worse and are likely now suffering in hell forever in that ontological state that they enshrined in their own lives. So it's really very sad and depressing, but also can be taken as a warning, too.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, that's one thought that has come up before from other commentators that, you know, these individuals like Nietzsche and so forth, you know, they never really found any happiness or fulfillment in rejecting God. So, you might want to think twice before following them. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been discussing here a new book, a republication by Sophia Institute Press of The Gods of Atheism, a 1971 book from Catholic priest and commentator Vincent P. Michelli. And we've been talking with Sophia Institute spokesperson Kristen Van Uden. Well, Kristen, thank you again for joining the show.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
And for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.